This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We've got two fascinating interviews today, talking about how human beings are changing the other species we share the Earth with. Later in the show, we talk with evolutionary biologist Beth Shapiro about how humans deliberately change other species. Her book is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. But first, Tor Hansen tells us about how many species are evolving to adapt to human-caused climate change. His book is Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. Hansen is a biologist and author of several previous books, including Buzz, The Triumph of Seeds, and The Impenetrable Forest. We've got a lot packed into today's show, so without further ado, here's our conversation. Tor Hansen, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
This was really a lovely book to read. I say lovely partly because I was a little apprehensive. You know, the news is bad in general, and I always have to steel myself a little bit to read bad news. But your book, you know, doesn't exactly look through rose-colored glasses, but it shows that there is some room for hope. And that hope lies in what we are learning about resilience and the response to climate change. Talk a little bit about that resilience.
Yes, I really wanted to bring a clear-eyed view, or as clear of an eye as I could bring to this topic, because I worry about it, I think, much in the same way that you probably do and that many of your listeners do as well. But I felt that something was missing from the discussion, in that so often we hear about the biology of climate change only in terms of that iconic image of the polar bear lonely there, stranded on its shrinking iceberg. And then the conversation moves on and we're into policy and other debates. And I felt that something was missing, in that the biology of climate change, the responses and the resilience, if you will, in nature is really what it all boils down to, in that changing the climate wouldn't matter too much if plants and animals got along just as well in any conditions. But of course, that's not how nature works. Creatures are adapted to particular environmental conditions. And so when you change those conditions rapidly, as we are doing now, they respond. And it is the sum of those responses that will really determine the future, theirs as well as our own. So I wanted to go out and really look for the responses that we're able to measure right now, playing out all around us in nature. Not so much the models and what we're predicting for the future, but what we can see happening and see what signs of resilience were there and what we might learn from those.
And you found quite a number of signs of resilience. One thing you talk about, well, all of this comes down, or almost all of it comes down to evolution. But we tend to think of evolution as something that happens gradually over many generations, and of course that's partially true. But you talk about something called punctuated equilibrium. What is that?
Well, this is a theory, or an aspect of evolutionary theory, that really came up only over the last few decades. But it sprang originally from paleontologists, people like Stephen Jay Gould, who had done a lot of work looking at fossil evidence over time and seeing how things sort of stayed the same in lineages of trilobites or other things you might be looking at. And then there were sudden periods of rapid change where old forms would disappear and new forms, or a diversity of forms, would appear quite rapidly in the fossil record. And Gould and a colleague of his came up with this idea that there are periods of rapid evolution in between these periods of stasis, or more slow evolution. And it really was a controversial idea, still remains one, but is something that we can see not only in fossils, but if we start to look at these periods of rapid change, what we're going through right now, we do in fact see signs of evolution in action moving quickly. And I think this is an important lesson that we learn from climate change biology that really has application broadly in our understanding of the past and of the future of nature on this planet.
You know, I just read an article about bacteria across the globe are evolving to eat plastic. Is this an example of that?
Isn't that fascinating? Yes, you can see it particularly if you look at things like bacteria that have so many generations in a short period of time. That's one of the systems that evolutionary biologists have used for a long time to try to understand the pace of evolution and how things work. And so you can see things play out because there is this rapid generation time going on in a petri dish or a vat of bacteria. And you see that happening, the response of those organisms to the things in their environment, these new plastics that are available. You do see creatures now evolving to consume those plastics. And I think that is a good example of how quickly evolution can work as the environment changes. In this case, the introduction of a potential new food source. We also see that sort of bacterial or microorganism adaptation going on in some places in consuming things like petroleum spills and so forth. If we look at the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico, there was a lot of microbic activity breaking down some of the oil in that terrible catastrophe.
Now, of course, I mean, we hope that we're going to have more complex animals than just bacteria that can respond quickly. And you give some examples in the book. Some species are more resilient than others. I wonder if you could talk about one of the examples, you know, maybe the one that's right up in your title where you talk about plastic squids. Talk about plasticity and kind of a more rapid evolution.
Yes, that's a great segue from the plastic degradation question. Let's talk about what biologists mean when they talk about a plastic species or plasticity. And that is this idea of flexibility in our responses to environmental change. Plasticity, that is a flexibility built into the genome of a species. It's already there so that when things change, that plant or animal has the ability to respond rapidly. And plasticity in nature is not evenly distributed. We see it in organisms that have broad ranges and sort of a generalist habit in nature. We see less of it in organisms that are specialists, that live in particular habitats and that maybe have specialized relationships with other organisms in that habitat, pollinator-plant relationships, for example. Those sorts of very narrow niches are less plastic than dandelions that can grow in gravel or along or what have you, that are generalists in nature. And if we look at plasticity and we were to choose an organism that might just win an Olympic medal if there was such a contest for being flexible, it might have to go to the Humboldt squid, which is a creature that lives in a broad suite of environmental conditions in the Pacific, from all the way down in towards Patagonia, Tierra del Fuego, all the way up north, almost to Alaska. It covers a broad range. But in the center of that range, in the Gulf of California, the squid are very large and have supported a commercial fishery for decades, until a series of climate-driven and climate-assisted marine heat waves began coursing through the Gulf of California, and the squid, you know, were no longer there to catch. The fishers assumed that they had moved, as so many organisms are doing in response to climate change. Everyone assumed that the squid had simply departed those waters for cooler places where they were more comfortable. Until biologists went out and surveyed and found that, in fact, the squid were still there, and in some places more numerous than ever. But instead of departing in response to that heat stress, they had responded with plasticity, with phenotypic plasticity, meaning their bodies had changed to an almost unrecognizable form. They change their whole lifestyle, triggered by that heat, so that they grew to only a fraction of their former size, maturing in half the time, living half as long, and reproducing in only a few months where it might have taken a year previously, so that their adult body size was so small that the squid could no longer bite upon the hooks that had formerly been used to catch them. So the fishers couldn't catch any, and the few that they might hook, they dismissed as juveniles or another species altogether. They had been throwing them back, but the squid were still there and thriving really in those new conditions by responding through plasticity.
And yet this summer we saw an unprecedented heat wave that boiled something like a billion sea animals. What happened to the squid? Do you know?
This is a great question. I don't have data immediately on the squid, although I was just in contact with Bill Gilley, who is one of the key researchers on that species. And he mentioned that the trend that they saw earlier and described in that paper several years ago has continued. And the average size of squid in the Gulf of California, as it has continued to warm, are even smaller now than they were. So there does seem to be continued plasticity in that species. But the point that you bring up about those marine heat waves along the West Coast, particularly the Pacific Northwest this past summer, the not only marine heat waves, but the air temperature getting so hot, really illustrates species that lack the plasticity of the squid. Because when that heat hit the intertidal zone at low tide, there were stretches of the beaches in British Columbia, Canada, and adjoining Washington state, where the intertidal creatures, which are not like the squid in terms of their mobility and their plasticity, they had no recourse when temperatures reached 120 degrees on the beach, and many, many of them, in some estimates, more than a billion, were literally cooked alive in their shells.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with biologist Tor Hansen about his book, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. You talk about the three responses to climate change pressure that are captured in the acronym MAD. That's Move, Adapt, or Die. You've mentioned move, and there's some adaptation here. But let's drill down a little bit more on this idea of move. You say that while creatures can move, the species within ecosystems don't all move together. So talk about the ups and downs of species moving.
It's a really interesting situation if you think about how many creatures are on the move at this time. The estimates are between 25 and 85% of all species on the planet are shifting their ranges in response to climate change. So even at the low end, that's one out of four species on the planet. And we have not seen a biological reorganization of this magnitude since the end of the last ice age. So it's really a dramatic event in nature. And part of the reason that it is so dramatic is just what you mentioned, in that not all species can move, and even the ones that are not moving in lockstep with one another. So if they move in different speeds, at different rates, in different directions, what you end up with are what we call novel ecosystems, combinations of species suddenly thrust together that have not, in recent evolutionary time perhaps, been together before. So that upends a whole suite of ecological relationships, everything from predation to competition to pollination, all these other relationships that really tie ecosystems together are suddenly up in the air for many species because they're not all moving at once. And so that leads to great uncertainty and great upheaval in ecosystems across the globe.
Could you give an example of that?
Oh, there are so many examples, but let's talk about one that has gotten some bit of press over the past decade or so, but is worth considering because it has such a broad impact on a number of species. And that has to do with the bark beetles that traditionally have been restricted to portions of North America south of the sort of the frost line, if you will, places where it gets so cold that they can't persist through the winter. And these bark beetles feed particularly on lodgepole pine, which is a dominant species of pine in parts of the Rocky Mountains and then north up into Canada, all the way up close to the Yukon. They go far, far north. And those northern populations had not experienced bark beetle infestations of this type of beetle in recent memory. So that when these bark beetles were, in a sense, released from that restriction of the cold temperatures and were able to move farther north, they encountered naive populations of trees that had few defenses against them. And so as that population moved north, they started developing what we call a positive feedback loop. They moved north into trees that were less susceptible, which led to greater populations of beetles and a faster acceleration of this migration northward. And so they moved all the way north, almost to the Yukon now, to the places where it still remains cold enough in winter to kill them off. But it didn't just lead to northward movement, it also led to elevational movement, in that these mountains that used to be so cold, mountain passes and so forth, that the beetles couldn't cross, suddenly they could get over the mountains. So they went over the Rockies and went east and are now chewing their way across portions of Canada, again, where the tree species are naive to this sort of beetle attack. So if you had had trees and beetles moving together, you would have had the same relationship moving northward, but the movement of trees or the dispersal of these pine trees that, you know, could indeed breed and move northward is not happening at the same pace as the beetles. The beetles are far outpacing the resistance to beetles that should, in a perfect system, move along with them.
And there's a perfect example of that in my own town, East Hampton, New York. We have had a huge infestation of southern pine bark beetles. They had to cut down thousands of trees. And just the other day, there was a new population that was found in my absolutely favorite state park in my town, Napeague State Park, which is filled with the most beautiful coastal pines, which are now infected. And I'm just feeling bereft already.
It's a devastating loss to see those wonderful stands of trees come down.
Yes, there really is. Adaptation is the second one in this MAD acronym. Tell us about the bears in Alaska shifting their diet.
Isn't that a fascinating story? I think that we're all accustomed to thinking about brown bears or grizzlies, if you will, the coastal populations being absolutely linked with Pacific salmon. We may have seen these nature movies of the bears fishing in the creeks and so on. And it's just axiomatic, even in biological circles, that bears love salmon. Yet when a researcher named Will Deasy went to Kodiak Island to study those bears, he found something very remarkable happening in response to climate change. He was fascinated by how the bears always seem to be at the right place at the right time. And on Kodiak Island, there are many streams and rivers that have salmon runs that peak at slightly different times over the course of the summer. And Will was interested in trying to understand how the bears you know, divided their time and seemed to know exactly where to be at peak salmon for all of these different salmon runs. So he had gone up there and radio collared 40 bears, and he had put in fish counters in the stream so he knew when the salmon were peaking and everything was chugging along as it should in his study, till right in the middle of the salmon season, the bears all left the streams. They just disappeared. And he was shocked and he couldn't figure out what was going on. But he said, luckily, his team had these radio collared bears so they could follow them. And they followed them up into the hills and realized that the bears were all feasting upon a particular berry, red elderberry. And this is not a new idea, bears eating berries, because everyone knew that bears ate a lot of berries sort of at the end of the salmon runs in the fall when the berries were ripe. The bears would switch over and feast upon those carbohydrate-rich berries. But what had happened with the red elderberry is that it had responded, had been responding to climate change by blooming earlier in the springtime and fruiting earlier, so that it had pulled this peak berry season for elderberries right back into peak salmon season and had forced a choice upon these bears. And given that choice, it was hands down for the bears that they would choose to eat elderberries over salmon. And that really was remarkable to Will and his team in that it forced them to take a second look at these elderberries and realize that, it, in his words, it's a weird berry. Rather than just having a bunch of carbohydrates, which is what most berries have, they're sweet and full of sugars, and they're important for bears to put on weight at the end of the season, the elderberries have 13, 14% protein in with that carbohydrate mix, which is precisely the sort of diet that a bear will choose for itself in captivity if you give it a buffet line. And this is a better diet, it turns out, than salmon, which is primarily protein. And if you can imagine the dilemma for a bear, that big body size requires a huge amount of body fat to make it through the winter. So their priority over the summer and into the fall is not necessarily to eat as much protein as they can find. They want a combination of protein and starches that will lead to the buildup of fat. And they can build up more fat eating elderberries than they can on salmon alone. Because salmon is so high in protein, it's like the Atkins diet or the South Beach diet, one of these fad diets that we see in people where if you eat primarily protein, your body can't turn that into fat and you lose weight. So for the bears, the answer was clear. Driven by this change in the timing of the bloom and fruiting of elderberries, it forced the bears to choose, which led to this revelation among the biologists that this perfect bear food, the elderberries, had been hiding in plain sight all along. And it represented an interesting adaptation for the bears that could, in fact, in that population at least, lead to even larger body size than they had been attaining by eating salmon alone.
And yet, on the other hand, you also point out that there is a cost to the ecosystem because it's a salmon-dependent ecosystem that depends on bears eating salmon and leaving, you know, basically the composted salmon around for other creatures. So what happens to the whole ecosystem when the bears shift to berries?
Well, it's interesting along those riparian areas, and this is what DC told me in our conversation. He said in the future, what he is interested in observing is the change in that riparian system and even off into the nearby hills and so forth, in that bears historically have been responsible for introducing key micronutrients from the ocean to this terrestrial system through the composting of these thousands and thousands of salmon carcasses that they drag out of the water up onto the shore that then decompose or that feed other creatures and that spread through that ecosystem. He told me you can even find ocean-derived nutrients inside the bodies of spiders and birds in that ecosystem because of how they're introduced into the terrestrial system by the bears. And so removing a portion of that salmon will most likely have a measurable effect on the ecosystem. The bears will still be bringing salmon early and late in the season, but if this overlap between elderberry season and salmon season persists, as it's expected to, there will be a gap in the middle of that season where the bears will be eating berries rather than salmon, and you'll see fewer salmon carcasses reach that terrestrial ecosystem.
Now, you looked at rapid climate change in the geological record, because that is the burning question, right? You know, can enough of life adapt in time to avert the worst of the kind of mass extinction that we are already in the midst in? So what did you find about that? How do you answer that question of can life adapt in a, you know, rapid situations? I mean, we spoke earlier about, you know, bacteria, but what about the ecosystems as a whole?
This is something that, you know, climate change biologists and paleontologists are all looking at in terms of trying to find examples in history of this, you know, in the history of the planet, where conditions have changed this rapidly, to look for parallels and see what we can learn from the past. In the geologic record, there are these periods of rapid transition, periods of rapid change, but it's also very difficult to nail down the parameters in terms of, you know, years or decades or centuries, because even when you have good resolution in the fossil record or the geologic record, you're more often talking about thousands of years. So it's difficult to find precise parallels and analogs in the fossil record, but the ones that they can find that show rapid change also show some signs of resilience in terms of the species that were in an area before the climate changed. If you follow sort of through, you know, thousands of years of geologic time, oftentimes in some cases, the species return, you know, they've moved and then returned to some of those ecosystems. So there's some evidence for resilience. But I think what makes climate change biologists and paleontologists worry so much about the present situation is that it's not just the climate change that is threatening plants and animals. There's a great example of this, I think, if you look at, you know, recent books about mass extinction. And if you look within the last several years, you know, The Sixth Extinction was a wonderful book written by Elizabeth Colbert that dealt a lot with the impacts of climate change and how that was exacerbating extinction rates on the planet in many, many ecosystems.
She was a guest on our show here, so.
Oh, she was, and she's brilliant, and it's a fabulous book. But what is fascinating to me is that if you look back just about 30 years to the early 1990s, there was another book called The Sixth Extinction by Leakey over in Kenya. And what's interesting is he wrote that entire book without the phrase climate change appearing once. And it reminds us that we were already in a mass extinction event before the impacts of modern climate change became clear. So what we see in this modern situation is a double whammy, if you will. An extinction event already ongoing through habitat loss and pollution and other human impacts, now exacerbated by the additional layer of these climate impacts. And that's one of the things that really sets this period of change apart from anything that we can find in the fossil record.
So that leads me to my final question, which is, at the end of the book, Thor Hansen, you link what species are doing to what individuals can do to deal with climate change. And I found this to be a very kind of a unique perspective, because, you know, we're pretty used to saying, well, yes, you have to change yourself as an individual, but the crisis is so big and it's happening so fast that we need to focus on policy. You kind of turn that around.
Well, this really came out of spending so much time researching this and looking at what individual species of plants and animals are doing and looking at what individual creatures are doing in the environment. And if you look at that perspective, you see that they're doing everything they can to cope with climate change. And I think we can take a certain inspiration from that in our own lives to do everything we can. And you bring up a great point that we're often told that this is such a vast problem that individual action is immaterial. You can't make a difference in a problem so large, and that we should wait for some sort of top-down policy solution to this crisis. But I've come to believe that that perspective is wrong, and not just a little bit wrong. I think it's the opposite of the truth. And I think that what we really need to combat climate change is a fundamental cultural shift in our relationship with energy, not just how we use it and how we produce it, but how we even think about it, how we consider it. And we should begin to really consider it as something precious. And so when we start to think about a cultural shift, that is by its very nature the sum of individual actions. That means that individual action is more important in this crisis rather than less important, which is precisely what we see in nature, because we have learned that it is the sum of the individual responses of plants and animals that determine and are determining the fates of ecosystems across the globe. Similarly, it is the sum of our individual responses that will determine our own response as a community, as a society, as a species, if you will, to this crisis.
And of course, if we're doing all that we can, we're both changing our lifestyle and we're bugging our politicians as well.
Isn't that true? I was on a show not too long ago with a reporter from the Washington Post who made a very interesting comment. And she was pointing out that the spate of extreme climate events that we've been seeing over the past year, longer really, but very concentrated in the past year with, heat waves that we've been talking about, but also hurricanes and floods and fires and storm events. She felt that the polling data was showing how those immediate events in the lives of people around the world were starting to help make the connection that, you know, climate change is not this remote future problem, but something that is impacting daily life. And she felt that was an important transition culturally, in that we are much better as individuals and as a society in responding to immediate threats rather than something we perceive as abstract and distant. And that may be, if there is any upside to these horrible climate catastrophes, it may help spur us along towards individual and collective action.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much, Thor Hansen. Your book is Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. It's a terrific book. It's really fun to read. And it does leave me with, well, a little bit of hope.
Good. Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed all of your questions.
Thor Hansen. Watch a video about his book at writersvoice.net. And next up, stay tuned for Beth Shapiro and Life as We Made It. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. People have been changing other species for 50,000 years. For example, human pressure helped drive the mammoths to extinction. But now, with new genetic engineering tools like CRISPR, our power to shape the evolution of other species is practically godlike. That might be a good thing in some cases, not so great a thing in others. I spoke about the pros and cons of these godlike powers with evolutionary biologist Beth Shapiro. Her book is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth Shapiro, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
You look into the whole role of human beings for 50,000 years in breaking the rules of evolution. What do you mean by we broke the rules of evolution?
So that's a funny way to think of it. But yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. You know, in my day job, I'm a scientist. I work in a field of research called ancient DNA, where we go out into the fields and we collect bones and plant leaves and other remains of organisms that used to be alive. And we use the DNA that we can extract from these, you know, subfossil-like remains to try to reconstruct how other species and our own species have changed over time. And I've been particularly interested in how plants have changed and animals have changed, both because of things like the ice ages coming and going, but also because of people and how when people start to interact with plants and animals, they really change the way that the selective environment, the environment in which these plants and animals live. Take, for example, I guess that one of the easiest things for people to think about is domestication. You know, when people started to choose which gray wolves or which aurochs, which are the ancestors of cattle, got to survive, they were choosing animals that maybe had a better chance of surviving with people than they would have in the absence of people. So in the wild, an animal that ran away might have a good chance of surviving and passing their genes on to the next generation. But in a human environment, the animals that didn't run away had a better chance of surviving and passing their genes on into the next generation. And so in this way, humans have been an extremely strong selective force, breaking the rules of evolution by really becoming their own evolutionary force.
And of course, as you say in this book, that's gone to very extreme lengths in our current modern era. But I want to start way, way back, because you're a scientist who works with ancient DNA. So tell us about your work.
Yeah, so I have for a couple of decades now been really interested in what we can learn by extracting DNA and genetic information from things that were alive, you know, really spanning almost the last million years now, but focusing mostly on the last 50, 60,000 years, because DNA survives pretty well, especially in cold places over that time period. I've worked a lot on bison and horses and some about people as well, and really trying to understand when populations were growing and shrinking, when we had local populations become extinct and then be replaced by something else. So we've seen, for example, that as the last ice age, the coldest part of the last ice age was around 20 to 25,000 years ago. As that really cold period approached, lots of species that lived in Alaska and Yukon at the time really declined in population size. Their habitat started to disappear. There wasn't so much for them to eat, and their population started to crash. But then when it got warmer again, after the peak of the last ice age, their populations rebounded, but only to a certain extent, because now there were, for the first time in their evolutionary history, a whole bunch of this new predator that stood upright and walked on 2 feet and carried tools that they'd fashioned specifically for killing those animals. And so what was the impact of this new predator? And of course, that was us. That was our ancestors, people. What was the impact of people on these populations? And of course, we know the answer to that for things like mammoths and horses in North America. And that is that we drove these populations to extinction at that point. But other species survived. And some of that survival is also because of decisions that people made, deliberately changing the way that they were hunting, deliberately changing the choices that they made when they breed plants. And in the early 20th century, deliberately starting to do things like actively conserve species.
And you started out your studies on ancient DNA with bisons. And you say in this book, Life as We Made It, that bison encapsulate our species' takeover of the evolutionary process. So what did you learn from your studies of bison that led you to that conclusion?
What I meant by that is that we can see how the evolution of bison was shaped both by climate and much later by people. And, you know, bison were doing extremely well until around 30,000 years ago, when it got very cold, their habitat started to disappear, and their population started to decline. And then after the ice age, the grasslands returned, and bison did extremely well in some parts of the North American continent. And part of this was because, you know, at this point, there weren't any more mammoths, or there were very few mammoths and horses that they were competing with for access to this grassland. And part of it was also because people had discovered that bison were good to eat, and they were deliberately changing the way their strategies for killing them to try to preserve them. There's strong evidence from the fossil record that there was very good relationship between indigenous people much, much later. I mean, initially, we see that bison nearly become extinct around the same time that horses and mammoths went extinct. And there is archaeological evidence of people driving them off of cliffs in mass. And really, I mean, there are tools that different cultures were making that were deliberately fashioned to kill as many bison as possible. So people were really relying on bison for food. And it was also, you know, there are stories and there's dances and there is traditional knowledge about interactions with bison that go way back to the beginning of the time that people were in North America. And then we see the bison rebound. So they nearly go extinct around 13,000 years ago, and then they rebound and they are extremely successful on the North American plains until Europeans arrive in North America, bringing with them horses, which were native to North America, but became extinct. So they were reintroduced with Europeans to North America, and also guns. And this made it possible to kill a lot of bison very quickly. And by the late part of the 18th century, bison were nearly extinct. Some of the records suggest that there were as few as 100 individuals left in North America at the turn of the 20th century. But this is also the time when people began what I like to think of as yet another transition in our interaction with other species, where we decided, our ancestors decided, that we didn't want the bison and the passenger pigeon, these were the two species that really motivated the early conservation movement in North America, to become extinct. And so we started to pass laws and shape new strategies to protect them. We created places for them to go in the new protected national park system. And bison today are doing just fine, but they are incredibly strongly managed. You know, bison today live in conservation herds or they live in wild herds, but in both situations, they're protected by our laws. People decide how many individuals survive and reproduce. They decide which individuals reproduce. They vaccinate them to protect them from disease. They fence them in to protect them from predators. They are wild. These are wild animals, but they are wild in a new way. That means that they are wild in, and they also live with us, protected by us, and provide services to us. And this is really what I mean by and how we are driving evolution. When we started being to conserve species, to protect species, in addition to hunting them and herding them, we took over the evolutionary trajectory of pretty much every species that's alive today. And that, I think, bison very nicely encapsulate that transition.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Beth Shapiro about her book, Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. And the bison are a perfect example of that. However, there are many and can be many unintended consequences. Let's fast forward to today. You say today's biotechnologies make it possible to engineer species' genomes to help them adapt to drier soils. Sounds great in terms of climate. More acidic oceans, more polluted streams. That we could create gene drive systems to wipe out invasive species and even resurrect extinct species to restore missing ecological interactions. But that puts me in mind of, you know, the joke when I was a kid, you know, what could possibly go wrong? Go wrong, go wrong. For example, if we wipe out enough of the insects that we define as pests, what happens to the birds who depend on them for their food source?
You know, there's all, I love to have these sorts of conversations because obviously there are unintended consequences to things, but you know, we actually can't do any of these things yet. And one of the things that I've liked about writing this book and talking about these things is that it's a great opportunity to really talk about what these technologies can and can't do and all the different ways that we can evaluate the different risks that might be associated with deploying them as tools for conservation. So if we think about, so for example, you brought up the mosquitoes. The idea here is that we might create gene drives that drive specific species of mosquitoes, Anopheles mosquitoes, or mosquitoes that carry disease in Africa. We're thinking about malaria carrying mosquitoes. And in South America and other parts of the world, we're thinking about mosquitoes that carry things like dengue virus and Zika virus. Not all mosquitoes and all insects carry diseases that are a huge burden to human populations around the world, but some do. And what's excellent about the way that we're thinking about these new technologies is that if we introduce one of these gene drive systems, and the idea of the gene drive for mosquitoes would be to introduce a mutation that means that individuals can't reproduce. So it temporarily drives the population size of mosquitoes very far down. They'll rebound because the gene drives don't last forever. But right now we spray, you know, we spray huge amounts of pesticides onto the landscape, and that drives the populations temporarily down, but it's not specific. It actually kills all of the insects that might be out there that the birds are feeding on. But these gene drive systems will allow us to pinpoint with precision just the ones that carry disease. So it's actually good for the birds that are relying on these insects, because we're not killing everything that they eat. We're only killing the ones that are actually damaging to people. But as I say, we don't have many of these technologies yet. I mean, they're in deployment. I think they're extremely exciting as far as our possibility to really help create a future that is both biodiverse, including the birds that rely on insects, and the insects that we don't want to kill all of, because these insects are incredibly important for agriculture and for biodiversity, and filled with people, which I think is the kind of future that we want.
Yeah, but you yourself point out in this book that, yes, gene drives that we have today peter out in succeeding generations, but that there are technologies already in the works that would prevent that from happening, that would, in fact, you know, the gene transformation would go down through the generations. And you call that out as a danger as well. What systems are in place, if any, and what are needed to make sure that we don't, you know, shoot ourselves in the foot and destroy? We don't know everything yet. In fact, we know very little about our ecosphere, about the oceans, about the ways we're just on the cusp of knowing this. What do we need to put into place to make sure that we don't unintentionally destroy ourselves, which we seem to be doing already?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, your last point. We are already unintentionally destroying ourselves. And I think that we have to be very careful about managing our risk and our expectations, because if we don't, if we just say we're never going to understand fully what all the possibilities are, and therefore we're not going to use this suite of technologies that really do have the potential to benefit us, then we're dooming ourselves to just go along this trajectory that we're currently on. I think we must allow ourselves the ability, the time, the space to fully evaluate the risks that are there. The gene drives, you know, there's a bunch of people who are working on developing this technology. They haven't been deployed in any way that doesn't include petering out, as you say, or dying after a few generations. There are several different approaches that have been proposed that would put sort of stop mechanisms in gene drives. And another thing to think about is, if we can drive a trait into a population, we can just as easily drive that trait out of the population if we see what's happening. But what we should be most aware of is that these things are extremely heavily regulated. They don't actually exist in any true format. And there are lots of discussions going on at both the national and international level about what they might mean, when we might want to use them, and really trying to engage every possible stakeholder, local communities, global communities, people who might be impacted from it downstream. And there really isn't a race to get these out there. You know, people really are deeply considering the implications as they understand them for these technologies. But absolutely, you know, there are some risks down the line, and we don't fully understand what these risks might be. But I would argue that we do have to allow ourselves the space to explore what these technologies can do. Otherwise, there's a far, far greater risk in just abandoning them. They have such potential to really help us, and we really need them. But, you know, gene drives aren't the only biotechnological solutions that people have been thinking of. And there are many other solutions that are potentially less risky, but also take advantage of these new tools that we have. the example of the black-footed ferret is the one that always comes to mind to me. This is a little carnivore that used to be super widespread across the North American plains. They eat prairie dogs, and prairie dogs make these complex burrows and tunnels, prairie dog towns, that disrupt farming and all the infrastructure associated with farming. So throughout the 20th century, there were these successful active campaigns to get rid of prairie dogs, and they were kind of successful in getting rid of prairie dogs, but there are still a ton of prairie dogs, but they were extremely successful at getting rid of black-footed ferrets. When the Endangered Species Act was first created, black-footed ferrets were one of the original species that was listed for protection. And there was a population that was left, and they were brought into captivity, but the scientists from Fish and Wildlife Service and other organizations couldn't really figure out how to make the captive breeding work for black-footed ferrets. And eventually that population died. People thought black-footed ferrets were extinct until in the 1980s, a population was discovered near Meteetse, Wyoming. And this gave everybody a second chance, a second shot at trying to make captive breeding work. And it did. It was successful. Unfortunately, the population in the wild started to show signs of illness. And toward the end of the 80s, I think, they brought the last remaining wild individuals into captivity. Today, they release black-footed ferrets into the wild. There are about 500 black-footed ferrets from this captive breeding facility that are released. But when they get released into the wild, they eat a prairie dog, and that prairie dog is often sick with plague, a disease that was introduced from Europe. And the black-footed ferret gets plague, and they die. There's a vaccine. You can vaccinate them, and then you have to capture them from the wild and revaccinate them. So this isn't really a sustainable conservation strategy. But our new tools, our new biotechnologies offer a couple of solutions for the black-footed ferret. And this is as an example of what we might be able to do. First of all, there is at the San Diego Zoo, there's an organization called the Frozen Zoo, where they have tissue samples from animals and plants that are endangered or are extinct in the wild now, that were captured and deep frozen so that the cells of these samples are still alive. And there are several black-footed ferrets that are part of this collection. And these are black-footed ferrets that are from the other population that went extinct some decades ago. And about a year ago, Revive and Restore, which is a nonprofit conservation organization based out of Sausalito near San Francisco, in collaboration with Fish and Wildlife and the Smithsonian Institute and the San Diego Zoo, a couple of other academic partners, helped to take one of those frozen tissue samples and clone it. And a kit, Elizabeth Ann, was born using our cloning technologies, the same technologies that brought us Dolly the sheep in the 90s, right? And Elizabeth Ann has an entirely different genetic background from the black-footed ferrets that are in the captive breeding program today. And when she becomes part of that breeding program, her DNA, she will be an eighth founder lineage, an incredible win for the amount of diversity in the black-footed ferret population, which will be fantastic. But this isn't going to solve the problem of exposure to plague. And this is where we might turn to yet another one of the biotechnological advances that we have today. The cousin of the black-footed ferret, the domestic ferret, it's an evolutionary cousin, is naturally immune to plague. And so this group of partners are working right now to try to figure out why, how is the domestic ferret, what about the domestic ferret's DNA makes it not get the plague and die? The domestic ferret evolved in Europe with the plague, and so presumably this is how this evolved. And so once this is discovered, their plan is to take that bit of domestic ferret DNA and insert it using CRISPR gene editing technologies into the genome of the black-footed ferret, creating a black-footed ferret that's mostly black-footed ferret, but slightly augmented in its DNA with maybe a gene or two or several from domestic ferrets that makes itself not susceptible to plague. So this is one of the ways that we might use these technologies to help species adapt to these habitats that are threatening them today by moving genes among evolutionary lineages that have evolved in other natural systems.
And that sounds wonderful. Although I also have to say that, you know, prairie dogs have their defenders, and they are a very key species for the prairie, which is, I think, brings up the whole point.
Oh, but I mean, let me just interrupt there. Yeah, the bringing back black-footed ferrets is not going to harm prairie dog populations. There are
no, I know that. The point I was going to was the whole idea that we as a species have the right to extirpate other species like the prairie dogs because they interrupt our farming. I think is the. We have to be very cautious when we're using the kind of technology that you talk about in this book, and some of it is absolutely wonderful. But I get uneasy at the idea that somehow we have the right to do whatever we want with the other creatures with whom we share the earth. Now, of course, we already have to a certain degree.
Not to a certain degree, to a tremendous degree. I mean, we've spent our entire existence as people on this planet changing the evolutionary environments in which other species live. What I'm arguing is that we now have the capacity to think a little bit more about the future as we're doing this. And rather than just make things become extinct or remove things from human society or get them out of our way when they annoy us, think of ways that we can actually live alongside all of this other biodiversity and take advantage of the tools that we have at our disposal to help that happen.
And that would be wonderful, were it not for one thing, and that is that we live under a kind of economic system in which the decisions are often not made that are in the interests of the creatures with whom we share the earth, or even in the interests of many of us, but are really in the interests of the bottom line. And you point out, for example, that for biotechnology researchers, the choice is often between poorly funded academia and profit-motivated industry. And I guess that's where I think the unintended consequences can really come.
Well, isn't this exactly why we need to be having these conversations? I mean, the reason that we have this dichotomy where the only people that can afford to do this are these big companies that have lots of lawyers and are well-funded to be able to fight things and fight through bureaucracy is because we have this, we live in this environment where everyone is so scared of this. There are so many regulatory hurdles that one has to jump through. I mean, if you think about what happens when, so there's a woman who has a research group at UC Davis, Allison Van Eneman. And she is working on creating a gene-edited cow, dairy cow, that doesn't grow horns. So this is an animal welfare, animal rights issue. When dairy cattle, there's these very extremely well-adapted cattle that make loads of milk using way fewer resources and less space and making less pollution than they did 20, 30 years ago, because we've been engineering them using breeding technologies to be these incredible dairy cattle, but they grow horns. And these are dangerous. And so they're legally required, farmers are legally required to remove them. And it's an expensive and painful process that they go through. But beef cattle, Angus cattle, by some evolutionary change that happened thousands of years ago, naturally don't grow horns. They're hornless. And so the idea, and they know exactly what gene it is that causes this hornlessness in cattle. So her idea was to collaborate with a company that was able to do this and to transfer that hornlessness allele from Angus cattle, from beef cattle, into dairy cattle. If you bred them like normal, which you could do, you would create an animal that's half beef cow and half dairy cow, and it would be neither an elite beef cow nor an elite dairy cow. But if you just move this one gene, you get to keep all of the stuff that makes dairy cows great dairy cows. They just don't grow horns. And so she has done this. They were able to transfer a little bit of DNA and have dairy cows born. Actually, they were bulls that were born that didn't grow horns. But because of the way that the legislation works right now, those animals are considered drugs. And they can't actually be given to farmers or sent to market without going through the exact same kind of thing that a new cancer drug would have to go through. And this would be decades or years, you know, this would be an incredible amount of time and a huge investment in resources for something that is really an animal welfare. I mean, what is dangerous about this? We've been eating this particular gene in beef cows for ages. We could have created these animals just by breeding them, but instead we just decided to move this just one gene to make it faster, better for the farmer's bottom line and for the people who want to actually have these animals to work with. Well, the farmers, I guess, is what I'm talking about here. but the FDA says, no, this is a drug and it has to go phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials. Of course, an academic group can't afford that. But that is because of the way that our laws have been established to deal with this sort of thing. And we really need to change this. And if we don't change it, then we do end up with, as you say, this situation where the only people who can afford to do this are people who are really only looking out for their bottom line, perhaps, and therefore not looking out for the best interest of the public.
Well, the book is fascinating. I have to say, Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth Shapiro, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Beth Shapiro is professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California at Santa Cruz, where her work has centered on the analysis of ancient DNA. She's also the author of How to Clone a Mammoth. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.